This is Palo Alto High School, a classroom in Palo Alto High School, and we're sitting with a teacher who's just about to, in about an hour, deal with a class of 60 kids of what age?
17 and 18.
17 and 18. And we're talking to Esther Wojcicki, who's the... teacher here. And that was a bell, so just to prove that we are in a classroom. And Esther was one of the group of people who came to the Salk Institute recently to discuss the notion of an education prize, part of the advisory committee for this. She's actually a journalism English teacher at Palo Alto High School, also happens to be to run Creative Commons as well. You're president of the board of directors of Creative Commons.
But, that's right.
But for this particular event, what we're trying to do is to circle back and have another conversation, a continuing conversation, about how you think the initial throat clearings were on this notion of doing an education prize, an incentive-based innovation in education. Mm-hmm. And also to just talk about the whole experience of being in the arena, mm-hmm. rather than talking about the theoretical perspectives of all of this. So one of the three questions that we had, if you remember, that we discussed before, were what would constitute an ideal education that prepared children for the 21st century?
Right.
Then how do we come up with some scheme for educating, improving a kind of educational FICO score? What metrics are used and so on? Is this a realistic effort? And our point, as you recall, was very much to suggest that the neuroscience research is critical, absolutely crucial to sort of figuring all of this out, because in these classrooms you've got bodies, but they're also got brains sitting on the top of their heads there. So we're talking about understanding how minds work as well. So with that preamble, lengthy preamble, let me sort of get some sense from you of where you think things are at this point.
So every day I deal with the 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds, too. And when they come to me, their brains are pretty much, I hate to say it, fixed. But they have a lot of sort of attitudes and behavior patterns and skills that they got in the first 15 years. Mm-hmm. And I think we talked a little bit about this in the meetings that we had, that the most critical years, in my view, are really the early years for kids. So while I get these kids in the 9th grade, 10th grade, so forth, the ones that I have the hardest time with are the kids who really didn't do well early on. And the question is, like, why not? Why did they fail? And usually their transcript tells you something about it. You know, like some kids have like learning disabilities, but other kids have no learning disabilities, but they still don't want to learn, or they still have some problems. And so, like, where do you start? You know, where do you go back to really find the problem? Where did it begin? And so my theory on this, now I have to just say it's my theory, is that the most important years are really the early years, so 0 to 5. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's, you know, what we're talking about, you know, the brain and the development of the brain and so forth. And if actually you look at research, some of the research that, you know, I've read, you know, that you suggested, was very interesting. You know, children's brains really develop in the first year tremendously. And if a parent does not nurture that, and if you don't talk to your child, and if you don't spend a lot of time with your child, instead of just like the first 3 years putting them in front of the TV or something like that, I think that puts the child at a real disadvantage. And so, you know, I can tell you what I'm doing here in the high school to compensate for it, but I think that one of the areas that I find most important is really to help parents understand what their children really need when they take them home from the hospital. Like, what kinds of things could young parents do, simple things, that would really ensure them of having a child that was intellectually excited about learning. And I don't think we do that. You know, like, for example, I know with my own daughter, my oldest daughter, when she had her first child, she was at a loss, you know.
Another bell.
Another bell.
Is this the lunch bell?
Indication, this is the lunch bell. It's over. she had this adorable little baby, you know, 4 days old, 3 days old, and the question was, now what? Now what do I do? You know, there were no instructions. Uh-huh. You know, here she gets the baby, and I was like, what do you do? So the only instructions were, you know, how to feed him, and how to now bring him to the doctor. You know, every month he needs shots and things like this. But nowhere were there any suggestions coming from anybody about what you might want to do to make a stimulating environment for your child. Nowhere. So, you know, what do the people do? They go to the TV, right? And they're like, oh, I see an ad for, I don't know, some kind of toy for your child. But, you know, there's no system. There's no, people just don't understand. I mean, it's just helter-skelter.
So one of the things that we identified two age groups. We
right.
said let's use there's two places where the neuroscience can actually sort of function as acupressure points, if you like. One is, as you just said, for the early years, the first few years. The second one was this transition from eighth grade to ninth grade, where there's a huge number of dropouts. And although you could imagine saying, well, that's a sort of remedial scholastic solution, mm-hmm. saving kids and reclaiming them and so on, it seems to me that that's also a neuroscience story there, because we're talking about the teen brain. We know a lot of stuff about this. Folks like Jay Geard, who is at Brains R Us One, have got some interesting work on all of these sorts of things. So it seems to me that applying neuroscience in both of those areas could in fact be a very powerful solution.
It could be huge, absolutely huge. So I suggest, you know, that we have some kind of an education program for young parents, just that would help them. And I'm sure that they would be thrilled to have it, because most young parents would. But then in the high school, we're talking about eighth grade, ninth grade. So that's the age when you really can have a huge impact, because that's the age when kids start to really feel their independence. You know, that's when parents are really fighting with their kids. You know, they have like, I want to do this, and the kid and the parent says, no, you're not going to do this, and so forth. So you can really have a huge impact on kids and their learning styles and things like that in the ninth grade.
One thing that when you said earlier, I'm just curious about this, because it sounded like the complete opposite of what one would intuitively sense. You said that even at this fairly young age, you know, in late teens, that you thought that they were fixed.
They feel sometimes like they're fixed, but you know, they come to you with 15 years of experience, right? 14 years, 15 years. But you can still have an impact on them at that age. I mean, I do every day. I have classes of ninth grade students every single day. And I do have an impact on them. So the older they are, the less effective I am, because they keep building.
So this really difficult problem, isn't there? Which is, how do you encourage individual development within a system which, by definition, since it's dealing with large numbers, almost has to be monolithically, I don't want to disparage it, but more you're talking more about a conveyor belt. How do you inject that capacity, the possibility for individual expression in there?
You know, it's actually easier than you think.
It is?
Oh, yeah. Right, let's just examine. I teach freshman English, right? So I have a certain skill set I'm supposed to teach. I have to teach them, you know, how to write a composition, how to read at a certain grade level and analyze things, and, you know, how to speak before a class. And those are basic sort of standards. Every state has the same or similar standards at the ninth grade.
Yeah.
So the question is, how do you engage each kid? Well, so instead of forcing kids to read a defined curriculum all the time, how about letting them select some of the things they want to read themselves? How about letting them write about some of the things they want to write about instead of telling them all the time what to write about? So what I'm doing is I'm asking them to participate in a way that actually doesn't happen in a lot of classes, because the curriculum is so defined. It's like, here's the book, this is what you have to learn, here are the tests, and by June you have to know all that stuff. So where does creativity come into that? It doesn't.
So in the class that you'll be teaching later, you will be allowing them to more sort of emergent properties kind of thing, where they rather than, as you, was that phrase you used at the meeting, the sage on the stage? Was
the sage, okay, so yes. So if you watch me as a teacher, I am not the sage on the stage. In other words, I'm not sitting there all, or standing there for the most part, all period long, telling them what to do, telling them what to think, writing it all on the board and making them copy it down. And then Friday's a test. I don't do that. No. So what I do is, for example, I give them ideas, things that they should be thinking about, and then I let them do a lot of research on their own. So, for example, they just wrote a whole essay on something called The Future of Reading. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't tell them what I thought the future of reading was, but I could tell them what I thought it was. But so I presented all these different options, you know, all the different devices that people have for reading. What are we talking about? The Kindle, you know, the Sony Reader, you know, now we have the iPad. We have textbooks. We have open textbooks online. Yeah. We have all these things. So the question I asked them was, where are we going? Where do you think we are going with reading today? And I did not give them the answer. Well, let's put it this way. I don't even know the answer. And so what was very interesting about it is that they did all the research. And not only that, they were really interested in doing the research. And I put them on computers. They did research on the computers. They talked to each other. They talked to their parents. They went to the Apple store. They played with the iPad. They did all this stuff. And then they wrote a paper.
So you actually turned them into journalists, into reporters.
I turned them into investigators.
Investigators.
They're investigating, yes, their own world.
So on that particular subject, they've probably gone around and they looked at the current issue of the American Scholar, I think, has got an article about the future of reading. Then there was something in the Atlantic. They'll dig all these things out, try and figure out whether they agree with them, disagree with them.
Right. So then I started the basis off with an article about the future of reading that they could then agree with or disagree with.
Yeah.
But so it was very individualized because each kid got to respond in his own way. And he wasn't right or wrong based on his response. So your opinion is not, you can never be marked wrong for your opinion. You can only be marked down if you don't support your opinion. And so then they learn to support. So then the idea is, why would you ever want to quote anybody? What's the advantage? Because kids are always, so plagiarism, you know? So I said, you know, you're going to be marked down if you copy somebody else's work, but if you quote them, you get lots of credit. It's really exciting because it shows that you've gone out and done some research and mm-hmm. gotten other people's ideas and you incorporated it in your own work. So that they are excited about that.
So one of the things that came out, we just came back from this Education Innovation Summit at Arizona State University, and the introductory, the questions were, how do we educate in a rapidly changing world? How do we focus information and technology to produce meaningful change? Some of the people who were your colleagues at this advisory meeting, Michael Horn was there, Bob Bowen was there, Nelson Broms was there. And the introductory talk was given by Michael Crowe, president of ASU. And one thing became very clear in the course of the meeting, which was that he's talking about people going into university now who were born in 1990-something.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? It's exciting.
And he said it's totally... Just forget it. Forget about what you thought. They use technology in their different ways. There was a Google education evangelist at the meeting, whose name was Jamie Jamie, I'll talk to you about it later. And he described being in Africa. Mm-hmm. I think you said Kenya, I'm not sure. And having somebody coming up to him from the education department somewhere, basically saying, look, what we need is more computers. We need many more computers. We need lots of these, you know, computers and so on. Behind this person were three kids doing this. Two thumbs up, as Nelson Brumms would say.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, they were already, the platform wasn't absolutely essential. It was the access to the worldwide, to the internet.
Right.
So do you see in, you know, in I mean, you're in the middle of a highly connected hub here. I mean, it's Palo Alto, Silicon Valley, and so on. Does that resonate with you? You
see? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my students know so much. They are, so in order to tie into them, they're all on Facebook, and they're all in my Facebook group. So I can send them a message about what assignment I want them to do. Like, I could do it right now if you wanted, you know? I could send them a message for my seventh period class, the one that's going to come in about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
I could send them a message and tell them to come in now, and that in 10 minutes you'd see them all here. They're all on their Facebook accounts. So as an educator, I'm using this technology all the time. They're using the technology. They're completely tied in. But most schools, you know what happens in most schools in the country. They're not allowed to use they can't use their cell phones. Facebook is usually blocked.
Right.
Teachers are not allowed to have any connection with students on a Facebook account. They're not supposed to interact on the internet with their students. You know, I have a Google group for my students, so that I also send out assignments on that Google group. Because it's really simple. I save paper, I save time.
Yeah,
I think it's a problem that we have all these rules. It's the Children's Internet Protection Act. And while it's protecting children, it's creating blocks for teachers.
Yeah, one of the people at the Education Innovation Summit was describing, I can't remember if it was Jamie or not, but when you go into this classroom, there is the container there where you kids have to put their cell phones.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you know,
there's obviously pros and cons there,
because yeah. Obviously, yeah. You know, you don't want classroom anarchy either, everybody not paying any attention.
Right.
And all the research that shows whether, you know, we also came back from Vanderbilt and talked to some researchers there who work on attention, and it's certainly not clear that multitasking is a particularly brilliant idea, because you end up doing eight things poorly, at least according to some of these researchers. At least the neuroscience can begin to answer some of those issues as well.
Right.
So this sounds like there's going to be quite a little bit of research needed to go into this to figure out what's the best way to go about this, to maximize people's access to all the new technologies.
I don't know how we're going to do it, actually, because we have two acts. You know, it's called, one is Children's Online, it's COPA, it's Children's Online Protection Act, that's one. And I think the other one is Children's Internet Protection Act. And both of those make schools very nervous about allowing students to be online. And some schools even block search engines,
right.
All search engines, not just one. And then instead they buy these services that basically sanitize the entire web so that it looks like the web, but actually everything has been pre-selected and sanitized, so a school district wouldn't ever have to worry about being sued. Kid would never access anything that might be controversial. Pictures are all censored. Everything's censored. You haven't heard about these?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think that... Somehow the policymakers need to give kids at least above the age of 15 more rights, more actually to access the real web. As actually we should be training kids how to access the web and how to distinguish fact from opinion, how to determine whether a website is credible or whether it's not credible, you know, how to be an intelligent consumer. And so what's happening in many schools, we're just abdicating this responsibility.
So what's the role of the teacher then? Michael Horn was at the meeting that we had. He worked with Clayton Christensen on this Disrupting Education, Disrupting Class is the book, actually. Yes. Using computers, individual, self-driven instruction as a disruptive
technology.
That's what
it should be. It should be exactly.
And the teacher is what then? A mentor, a guide?
No, the teacher is, so I view myself as a guide on the side. I know it sounds kind of crazy, but in this class you will see that all 60 kids, it's a very big class, it's probably the largest in the district, they are self-organized. Well, of course I help get it started in September every year, but they're organized into groups. And so there's editors-in-chief, and then there's section editors and page editors, and there's the business staff and the ad staff, and like every single, and they all have a role and they work together. And they're in charge of their own program. And it's an incredible motivator. I mean, if you just think about it, the main thing that most people are fighting for worldwide is independence, isn't that? Don't we have wars about independence?
Uh-huh.
So kids want to be independent. They want to think for themselves. So if I promote this, they will do it. They come all the time. They do whatever they're supposed to do. They're just given a little guidance. But then I don't have to fight with them to do this. They produce these huge newspapers. Where did that newspaper go, by the way?
It's in my briefcase. Yeah.
Anyway, every 2 to 3 weeks. When they produce magazines. Here's one of the magazines. So here's a magazine. You know, this comes out every 6 weeks, produced by kids. And then there's a news magazine that comes out. Oops. This is every 6 weeks, too. So we have these kids are producing this stuff, but their ideas are here. This is their idea. This idea did not belong to the teacher. I don't come up with the ideas. How would you like to write about something that was always my idea?
Hmm.
I bet you wouldn't. Nobody wants to do that. And so that's what's happening in many of the schools. Everything is, they're told what to do all the time. And the teenage years, kids are extremely independent. That's what drives the teenage years. Independence and acceptance. They want to be independent, do what they want, and they want you to accept them. And just think about what's going on in this country. It doesn't work.
Well, but, all right, let me play devil's advocate for a moment there, since you raised this issue.
Okay.
Is it not also the case that at this age, adrift in a sea of doubt and emotional and hormones and so on, that people actually do like guidance?
Oh, yeah. They like guidance, they like structure, but they also want to be recognized. Or they want to work on things that they're interested in working on. You want to give them some options. Where are the options in the curriculum?
Well, you're the teacher, I don't know.
They're not there for the most part. You know, the reading materials defined, you know, you're taking math,
yeah.
You're learning exactly what you're supposed to learn in math. Science, all defined. You know, it's all decided. So the question is, you know, maybe I want to be a mechanic. You know, how does this relate to my future? Is kids have to understand how the subject matter relates to making them sort of a better citizen or a better consumer of information. We need to explain it more to them.
Yeah.
We don't. So those dropout kids are the ones that are they are the ones who are least likely to take direction.
Most of the stories that we've read recently in the media, we've discussed this to some extent, have been things like how to build a better teacher, fire yeah. bad teachers, a lot of stuff about teachers.
Right.
At the meeting that we were at, we discussed, well, maybe a good different approach would be how do you build a better learner, and that's where the neuroscience comes in. And obviously those two things go hand in hand. Hand in hand, and then it requires parents' involvement as well. I remember you saying that at the meeting.
Yes.
Here's the recent installment. Time magazine, Should Schools Bribe Kids? It's a bit of a attention-getting headline.
It is.
certainly, and it's about...
Some parents bribe kids, you know. I'll pay you for as many your A's.
This is about Roland Fryer's work, economist at Harvard.
Mm-hmm. I read the article. It was a very good article.
So, and again, the headline is Cash the Answer. What motivates kids to work hard in school? What motivates kids to work hard in school?
Well, I think cash, I think there are alternatives to cash that can motivate kids to work hard in school. And I would say that one of the main motivators is really acceptance and psychological rewards. So all the studies that I've seen show that kids that are connected psychologically to their teacher in some way are going to perform at a much higher level. And so I think the kids in my class get psychological rewards all the time because I try to tell them, you know, that you're doing a good job on this, you're not doing a good job on this, but maybe you can improve. And also the other thing that I use, I know this sounds kind of crazy, but, you know, I actually use food. And so, so I bring treats to class. Usually like once a week.
I hope they're organic and low calorie.
Well, sometimes they're candy. And I can tell you, kids will work their tails off for a little bag of M&Ms. And they get really excited about this. And I mean, it's just immediate reward. And it makes learning sort of fun. While I think it's okay, I guess, if I wanted to pay them $5 for every week, I'm sure that would work. But I think it's more fun and it's more exciting to get psychological rewards. So get recognition from your peers, recognition from your teacher, recognition from your parents. Mm-hmm. Get the food rewards. I would show you, I have candy here right now. I enjoy eating it too, those little gummy bears, and so do they. So, I mean, why not? And some of these, I read the article, so they pay kids if they do really well on tests at the end of the semester. That goal is too long, it's too far. It's hard for them to control all the factors that go into getting the grade. That doesn't work. You know, because they forget. And they have one thing happens or another thing happens, and then they get depressed because they're not going to get the reward. They need these rewards, you know, more immediate rewards, let's put it that way.
This is all very complicated stuff, whether immediate gratification is a good idea, whether they should learn delayed gratification. Even where you're talking about reinforcement schedules for learning information, mm-hmm. Hal Pashler at UCSD has been doing some work on that for the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center. So, again, I would say, not to get you in trouble with the Diet, Nutrition, Metabolism Police, or in one of our other programs, a lot of this stuff is tractable to research, carefully carried out, I would suggest. But I'm curious, how did you get into teaching in the first place? I mean, what was the story here?
How did I get into teaching? Well, I got into teaching actually very early, but I didn't realize that I was going to be a teacher. So at the age of 14, 15 years old, I was earning money to go to college, and there was a local parochial school that needed in the afternoon, they needed somebody to teach their PE program. Mm. And, you know, I was poor enough and hungry enough. I was like, sure, I'll do that, you know, for like whatever it was, $5 an hour. And I had no training whatsoever, and it was grades K through 6. And I had like one group and another group and another group and so forth. And what happened was that by some, I don't know, miracle or something, the kids really liked me. I liked them. And their program just like flourished. And so I thought, gee, maybe I know how to teach. But I didn't go any further than that because then, of course, I was only 15 or so. And then I went off to college and I majored in English, political mm-hmm. science, and then got a journalism degree and went to work as a journalist. I got married and I moved with my husband. And
he's chair of physics.
He's chairman of physics at Stanford.
Stanford, yeah.
And moved to Stanford, and the question was like, now what? what am I going to do? Because, you know, the journalist, the trained journalist, I didn't want to commute. So I decided I would teach. And so that's how I ended up in education. I thought, well, if I can't be a journalist and, you know, the newspapers were too far. It was in San Francisco. I didn't want to commute. So then I said, well, I'll go to Palo Alto High School and teach, be a teacher. I had gotten a teaching credential, but I just hadn't been using the credential.
Yeah. So did you try any of your techniques on your children when you had children?
I tried all my techniques on my children. My kids are products of my experiment, all three of them. So my theory was, the most critical years are 0 to 5. And they were reading books and doing all kinds of things. They had activities. By the age of 5, my youngest daughter, Anne, was the butterfly champion for Northern California. They were swimming and dancing and everything. And then I figured, well, after 5, you know, they can be on their own. But, and then when she was 5, I started substituting here in the school district. But yeah, no, I worked. That was, and it was just my own theory at that time, you know, that I thought a child's brain needed a lot of, you know, stimulation when they're young.
Is this an unusual, I know nothing about this high school, so is this an unusual high school that will let essentially a pretty experimental classroom to be, or do you not tell them?
Well, let's see, when I first arrived here at Palo Alto High School, there was a very defined curriculum for journalism. So they had a book, and the kids were supposed to read the book, and on Friday they were supposed to take a multiple choice exam. Let's see, about 4 months
it
into this program.
Sounds just like your kind of thing.
It was like, the question was, should I throw the book out or should I quit?
Yeah.
And so I like, I guess I'm going to throw out the book. So I threw out the book, and then I waited around to look and see, well, does anybody notice? And so turns out that the students got much more excited and much more engaged, and nobody seemed to notice that the book was missing. I was like, thank God. And so I continued this program, and I substituted for the book. I substituted, like, real newspapers. I mean, it's a journalism class. Why aren't we reading newspapers? Why are we reading this silly book? So the program started to grow. I guess word got out that it was seemed to be somewhat meaningful. And so within 3 or 4 years of being here, I started with 19 kids in the program, and in like 3 years, I already had 50 kids that were signing up. And I think Palo Alto actually is a community of intellectuals, and they were pretty understanding. And I even got support from, you know, the administration and from the district office. And so, I mean, the fact that the kids were learning and they were excited and their skill level seemed to be going up, nobody seemed to mind that I threw out the textbook. Thank goodness.
So one of the things that we've talked about at the Education Prize meeting is how do you come up with some of these strategies and how do they then become scalable? So often the problem is that you've got an innovative teacher, a Jaime Escalante died recently, or Rafe Esquith or somebody.
He's amazing.
Your way of doing these things in here. But that's not necessarily a scalable thing. That revolves around the personality and the passion and the vigor of the teacher.
Right.
So one of the tricks that one of the problems we're going to have to solve is how to come up with some of these exciting techniques that can be translated and scaled up.
Well, I've been thinking about this actually a lot.
Yeah.
And I was trying to figure out how can we engage kids more effectively. Because it's really engagement, you know, in the high school, because they're dropping out at just an enormous rate. It's about 7,000 a week. And one of my theories is that they're dropping out because the curriculum isn't relevant and also because there's such rigidity.
Mm-hmm.
I think one way that we could improve it would be to give teachers more freedom to allow students to do more project-based learning. And that might be easier for teachers to understand, you know, just say, think of projects that students could do, and the byproduct of that project would be learning the skills that you're teaching directly. Mm-hmm. Because just teaching, like teaching punctuation directly is really boring. But teaching punctuation in the context of doing a project, you know, like publishing something on the web, for example, you know, mm-hmm. a blog, kids then become really interested in learning grammar, because all of a sudden their writing is published and other people are going to read it. Mm-hmm. So then they have a motivation for like wanting to write well. So if we could enable project-based learning, I think that might scale. Right now, we don't have a lot of project-based learning in the schools. It's more teaching to the test that we have, thanks to the No Child Left Behind Act. You know, we teach to the test, kids fill in the bubbles on the Scantron sheet, and if they succeed in doing the right number of bubbles, then the school is rewarded, which I don't know. You know, so then you have to ask yourself, do kids really learn anything, you know, and they're not motivated. So if you take a look at the countries in the world where they score the highest on the PISA test, it's mm-hmm. the international test for skills, Finland is the top.
Right.
And Finland, if you look at Finland, first of all, their kids don't start school till 7. And the entire program is structured around a lot of project-based learning, collaborative learning, online projects, and things like that. So those kids are all learning stuff while they're doing the projects. Wouldn't that be an idea for us to, you know, I'm not saying we should do it for every single class in the curriculum, but if kids could just have one class per day, you know, out of 6 periods, 7 periods, if they had one class where it was devoted to some kind of a project that they uh-huh. were particularly interested in doing, I think it would make a huge difference. It would make what they're learning in the first 6 classes more relevant. And so that's one of the things that I was thinking about. And I know that, for example, the Hewlett Foundation, they just came up with a new plan for funding projects. And their new idea is they're going to fund projects that are called, they're based on what they call deeper learning. So I like, what is deeper learning? That right. sounds kind of interesting. And turns out deeper learning is project-based learning. So kids that learn skills so they can actually do them. You know, not just you learn how, you learn it on a superficial level. You learn so that you can actually do it yourself. Because in the process of learning that, you learn everything you need to know. So that's one of my ideas, hopefully. You know, it's hard to get it across, I think, to the state departments of education, because it's metrics. You know, how do you assess? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you make sure kids are actually doing this work and not just, quote, fooling around? I think that's a good question, and we need to have assessment vehicles developed to make sure that project-based learning is actually producing the results.
Yeah. This is obviously going to be an ongoing conversation. I'm looking at the clock now because we have to get you out so you can have lunch so you can come back and teach the class.
Oh, yeah.
So why don't we break now? Why don't we break now and then we'll come back
And you'll see the class.
Watch the class in action.
You'll see the class in action. It sounds terrific.
All right. Esther Wojcicki, thanks very much so far.
Thank you.